It's that time of year again. It's Author of the Week here on Radio Gorgeous. And returning to Radio Gorgeous is the divine Allison Weir with the fourth of her six Tudor queens. We're up to Anna of Cleve and the Queen of Secrets. Welcome, Allison.
Hello, Donna. Thank you for inviting me back.
We wouldn't have it any other way.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
So in the lineup of Henry's wives, we're back to divorced.
Yes, we are. Absolutely. But it doesn't end there. There's an after story and there's a before story.
Let's get to that. Who was Anna of Cleve?
She was a German princess, a ducal princess. She came from a small duchy, quite a powerful duchy, and on the borders of the Rhine. And she herself was a Catholic, but her family were affiliated to the Protestant League of Princes in Germany. And Henry VIII needed their friendship when the Emperor and the King of France ganged up against him, basically, because he'd been excommunicated by the Catholic Church. And so Henry looked to these, you know, this alliance, and Anna symbolised it. It was to be a marriage alliance.
And her parents were very interesting. Her father was quite worldly.
Her father was very enlightened for his time. He was a Catholic, but he actually broke with the Pope, like Henry. That's why Henry thought Cleve would be friendly towards him. But he stayed friends with the Pope, and he also encouraged reformers, even sort of dicing with Martin Luther. But it was quite an enlightened court for its time. It was quite strict in etiquette and that, and the way the princesses were brought up. But his son took over in that mould, but his wife, Maria of Jülich, through whom he inherited many lands, she was very strict, and she was a Catholic, and a devout Catholic, and she brought up her daughters in that way, but her son was brought up under the auspices of his father.
I got the feeling, and am I right in remembering that Erasmus was also a friend?
Yes, Erasmus. Oh, yes, it was an Erasmian court. Duke John and Anna's father was a great, he'd been a friend of Erasmus, and also, you know, imbibed his ideas and wanted to, you know, run his court on Erasmian lines. So he was, you know, very much a man of his time.
I got the feeling that Anna was sort of her father's daughter, but brought up by her mother, you know, living by her mother's rules.
Anna, we don't know much about Anna's views on religion. She seems to have been quite conventional. When she was in England, under Henry VIII, of course, I mean, you know, everybody was Catholic, supposed to be Catholic, but the king was head of the church, not the Pope. She made no protest about that. She didn't make a ruffle. When Edward became king, England turned Protestant, we don't hear anything about Anna making any protest. And then when Mary became queen and there was a Catholic restoration, Anna, of course, reverts to, you know, what she'd been brought up to. So she may have caught that enlightenment from her father and brother. And I think she was, but I do wonder if she took after her grandfather in one way. Her grandfather, Duke John II of Cleve, was called the Kindermacher, the baby maker, because he had 63 bastards. A lot of them were around court. They lived in, you know, they lived in the country houses of Cleve. Anna would have known them. So one wonders if anything of this had come through to her.
You do introduce that possibility to us, because, as you say, it would have been known to her, and those types of things, as in courts past, were acknowledged and open, if not honored.
If it was the man doing it, yes, it was. It was tacitly accepted. If it had been a woman, that would have been completely beyond the pale. A double standard reigned. Because, of course, women were the transmitters of dynastic lineage. If they bore a bastard child, it would corrupt that lineage, you know, and there would be no entitlement to it. So, you know, if women strayed, they were punished quite harshly, as happened with Anne Boleyn, as we know.
Yes. Anna also seems to have been uniquely unsuited to be Henry's wife.
Yes, in some way, yes. And it's not really her fault in a way. It's the fault of her upbringing, in that she, that the things that Henry admired in women, like dancing and making music and that kind of thing, even riding, were frowned upon at the court of Clever. And Anna was not brought, she was brought up to be virtuous, even brought up to cook. I mean, it was unthinkable for Henry's other wives doing that. But Anna was brought up in a very domestic sphere. I mean, you look at, think of the 20th century legend about German women, Kinderküche, Kirche. It, basically, that's it.
Yes, yes, cooking and cleaning. And
church.
That's your lot.
That is it, yes. That's how, and she was brought up never far from her mother's elbow, we are told.
Yes, and despite all of that, in your telling of her story, various bits of education passed her by. One of them was learning English, which she did not do.
She did eventually, but it took a long while.
Yeah, and that posed problems for her on her arrival in England. And there was sort of what we'd call sexual education that sort of missed her.
Yes, I think so, yes. I mean, one would have expected her mother to have acquainted her what to expect on marriage. Yeah, that was a mother's duty. But she wasn't expected to dabble with any of it beforehand.
and she may or may not have had some personal experience.
Well, what set me wondering was a comment Henry VIII made and kept on making after his wedding night, because the marriage was not consummated, and he said that he had felt her breasts and her belly, and they were very loose, and by other tokens and this and other tokens, he thought her to be no virgin, and he kept saying it. And complaining she was no virgin. If she brought maidenhead with her, I never took it. You know, that was the kind of thing he was saying to anyone who would listen. But I mean, people have said, oh, Henry was just being, you know, he wanted to wriggle out of it. And he did, there's no doubt about it. But finding out that your wife is not, your bride is not a virgin, is not grounds for an annulment. So why would Henry need to do this if he didn't genuinely believe it? But there's something else I took into account, that Henry had been married three times. He'd fathered 15 children, probably, including bastard children. He must have known the difference between a female body that had borne children and one that hadn't. Now, one could explain the slackness in another way, that perhaps stress had caused Anna to lose weight, as a lot of brides do, and especially if you're marrying Henry VIII. I mean, you know, in the weeks before your wedding, you could lose weight and that could account for it. This theory may be doing Anna a great disservice, but given her reputation after her annulment, it made me wonder.
Yes. Okay. So, well, let's get to the marriage, because Henry is eager as ever.
Oh yes.
You know, to have an heir. You know, more
he's
heirs.
He's eager to marry Anna because he's seen her portrait and clearly been smitten, and is so eager for her to come. There've been lots of delays fueling his ardour. And he gallops down on New Year's Day to Rochester, where she's travelling up in slow stages from Dover. And he travels down to meet her, in disguise with some gentlemen. And he comes in disguise, and he does the worst thing he could do, because she doesn't know who he is. They're all dressed alike. And he suddenly gets hold of her, embraces her, and kisses her. And she's outraged. You can imagine this, you know, and also, you know, there's this great big fat man, you know.
Yes, because she'd also received a portrait which was flattering.
I don't know about that.
Of Henry.
I don't know about that. She'd been told things that were flattering about Henry. And if there was anything hanging at the court of Clever, it probably several years old. So she didn't recognise him. In fact, she was watching a bull baiting from the window, and she turned back to watch it. She obviously felt that he announced a messenger was coming with gifts from the king. And once they'd had the initial greetings and she was angry, she turned away, obviously to indicate, well, that's it, you know, you leave now. And he went out of the room and the rest of them stayed. He came back in purple, you know, cloth of purple, and, you know, and looking like a king, royal robes. And all the other men started bowing. Can you imagine how Anna must have felt? I mean, she must have been completely wrong-footed. Not a good start.
That's the kind of thing that's just gutting.
It is, absolutely. Yes, I know. So it wasn't a good start. But after that, he was very courteous towards her. And she had no idea. I'm sure she had no idea at the time. What to expect, and that anything was wrong. And the marriage went ahead, although he was behind the scenes, he was doing his best to wriggle out of it, but he was told the contract was watertight, and he had to, he said, I must put my neck in the yoke. And they did get married, and then he did actually initiate sexual activity from his own testimony on the wedding night. And that to me suggests that it wasn't, he didn't, you know, he just decided he had to go through with it, because at the altar he was asked if there were any impediments by Archbishop Cranmer, and he said no.
So how does he wriggle out of it, as it were?
He wriggles out of it. He stays with Anna for a little while. He moans and groans. He doesn't consummate the marriage. Then he meets Catherine Howard. They marry in January. He meets Catherine Howard in April. Well, she's already at court, but he starts to, you know, she's thrust in his path by, you know. Anna is representing the reformist party at court, you know, the Protestant alliance. And Catherine Howard is pushed forward by the Catholics. These two parties at court. And it's at that point Henry decides to take, when things escalate with her, he decides to take action and end his marriage. And fate plays into his hands, because Anna was betrothed before. She was betrothed under the age of consent, which was 12 for girls, 14 for boys. And her betrothed, who was the son of the Duke of Lorraine, was also underage. So the promises were made for them. They had never made those promises themselves. Had they done so, it would have been binding. But the betrothal was broken informally. It was never formally broken. And when Henry asked for the Duke of Clever to send proof, they couldn't find any. So he gave that. That and non-consummation and the fact the king had not consented to the marriage were the three grounds on which it was annulled in July.
As with all of these fascinating stories, you tell it from her point of view.
Yes, that's my brief for this series.
Yes.
Each book is solely from each queen's point of view.
And with what they knew at the time of their knowing, and what information they would have been privy to.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting viewpoint. And as a woman today, it feels very restricting.
Yes, it is. And it gives you an idea of how restricted Queen's lives were. She stayed in her apartments unless there was a reason for her to come out of the court, perhaps to attend chapel with the king, perhaps to grace a ceremonial occasion or a banquet or feast or something. But basically, queens lived in their apartments. They had their own privy gardens, and they had their attendants. They had their officers who went out into the wider world. But it is quite, it's almost like being in a harem. I mean, there's more freedom, obviously. They could, you know, they could go and visit the king, you know, but generally the king came to the queen.
And given that, I mean, she went from, you know, was she princess of Clever or pawn of Clever?
Well, all princesses were pawns in one sense or another, yes.
And you really get that feeling.
She had a very sort of, you know, a protected childhood, strict upbringing, and, you know, with lots of constraints on her. And her sister chafed, we know her sister chafed at it because she wrote music secretly. But music, they weren't supposed to be doing that, you know. The Duchess liked to hear music, but they weren't supposed to compose it, they weren't supposed to sing, they weren't supposed to play. And then she went into the constraints of marriage. Can you imagine how she felt when she got this great divorce settlement with all this money? Freedom is opening out, you know. She wants to stay in England, she doesn't want to go back to Clever. And of course, at one point, she was so frightened to go back because she thought they would see the breaking of the down of the alliance as her fault, and her brother might kill her.
That was a real possibility.
Well, that's what she thought, but in the end, her brother was very understanding, and he was very angry behind. He didn't tell her, but the ambassador said he was very unhappy with Henry.
And so she was sort of dependent on the people in her house, and those were a mixed bag.
You mean her attendants?
Yes.
She had a staff of officers.
Yes.
And then the people she spent her daily lives with were her ladies and her gentlewomen and her maids of honour. And they were the ones who surrounded her. And that household was replaced to a large extent at the time for the annulment. She was given another house, a smaller household, but she was still very well looked after. She had a very good income. She was given four great houses. And there were a whole long list of dower properties. So she was a very wealthy woman.
Her divorce seemed to be the sort of best
it was
and most free of her life.
I think she welcomed it, to be honest. I think after she was very frightened initially. In fact, she ended up fainting and screaming because she thought they were going to she was going to have a terrible life like Catherine of Aragon or even Anne Boleyn.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these were the precedents.
Well, that's right, yes. So she agreed to everything. She didn't fight. She did at one point say that she believed she would be Henry's wife all her life. And then she sort of backtracked. But she just agreed, and with such alacrity and, you know, amiability, that Henry grew up very suspicious and thought, she's a woman, she's going to change her mind. And we've been literally, that's what the sources say.
That was what I think was the key to her happiness, was her very adaptability.
Yes, it was. Her amenability. Yes, it was. Yeah.
Yes. And that allowed her, after the divorce, that allowed her and Henry to become friends.
It did. Because he visited her. He married Anna was divorced on the 12th of July. He married Catherine Howard on the 28th. And he visited Anna on the 6th of August. And he came over from Hampton Court and had dinner with her. And it was reported they got on very well. And you can imagine, I mean, that was a great scene. I really enjoyed that. I had a field day with that scene. But he came actually to get her signature on certain documents of consent to do with the annulment. But it was a nice social occasion. He came again and they became friends. And it's very touching because in these years, inflation is becoming rampant. Prices double. Henry supplements Anna's income as it decreases in value, and she doesn't want for anything. And there's one lovely set of accounts that he's actually made an entry in his own hand in the margin for my beloved sister Anna, and they didn't have to put that, which I thought was lovely. So it gives you an insight.
It's lovely, but at the same time, he strikes me as almost a bit of a sociopath in the way that he can switch it on and switch it off. And, you know, I'm divorcing you. Like, part of it, you understand,
He was never unpleasant. She said to the German ambassador, the Clever ambassador, he had never treated her anything other than courteously and in a friendly manner. And they didn't actually, all the divorce negotiations were not conducted face to face. They were all conducted through other people. And so leaving the king able to, I mean, he was always, I mean, she came to Chris at court the following Christmas, sat at table with him and Catherine Howard. She danced with Catherine Howard and they all dined together and there was a lot of mirth and that. And the ambassadors are looking and thinking, wow.
Well, for her, I mean, the marriage was not a marriage. And I think it was more embarrassment and fear, as you say, that kept her. But that did give her freedom.
She knew something was going on.
Yeah,
she tried to see Thomas Cromwell to find out, you know, Cromwell wouldn't see her because he didn't want to get involved. He was trying to distance himself from this marriage he'd made. And of course, he ended up being executed on the day the king married Catherine Howard.
Which was another thing that made her quite amenable.
Absolutely. Well, this was before that. Yeah, but Cromwell had been arrested by then.
Yes.
Cromwell was in the Tower for a long while. They kept him alive so he could, depose, you know, give his evidence about the king not being willing to go through with the marriage.
Yeah. Very... It seems like the king was almost, like we've seen recently in the series The Queen, that there's the person and there's
the
king.
And sometimes it's hard to reconcile the person because when Henry wasn't beheading his wives, this is going to sound very strange, but when he wasn't beheading his wives, he was a really good husband and he was a very loving husband. In his lights, and according to the standards of his day, that meant it was perfectly all right when the Queen was pregnant to go and sleep with someone else because, you know, sex is taboo during pregnancy and the king has needs, you know, that kind of thing. But no, there is evidence of genuine love between him and his wives. I think between him and Jane Seymour, him and Catherine Parr. And he was very indulgent with Catherine Howard. And I've just finished the novel on Catherine Howard and it's very different to get this idea of this almost tyrannical king, this all-powerful king who's very suspicious and people call him the English Nero, and this indulgent husband. So it's almost as if there are two people. It's a bit schizophrenic, actually.
Yeah, yes, it does strike one. But it also, are you starting to feel a little bit like Henry VIII? You're galloping through wives.
Not really, no, because it's all of it is from the wives' point of view. And So we're getting Henry through their point of view. It was suggested there could be a book called Henry's Story, but I don't know about that. I'm not so sure.
That would definitely be cheating.
I think it would, yeah.
For you, you'd be like, no, can't do it. I don't know.
I could compress all six books into one.
Exactly. Well, so she is also similar to Catherine of Aragon, but she is actually rather long-lived.
Oh, yes, she is. I mean, she's long-lived, 41, you know.
But she survives Henry and Edward and gets through to Mary.
She does, yes, that's right. She dies in the last year of Mary, well, just before the last year of Mary's reign, yes.
And while she didn't have to, there were rumors that she had children, and that was, you have
a very romantic
explanation for that, which I think we should leave to the readers to
discover. I think we should.
But you definitely get the sense that she wanted to be a mother, and she wanted to be a stepmother to Mary
yes,
and Elizabeth.
Yes, I think that's true. She was a very warm person in many ways. She comes across as that way, you know, and that.
Yeah, she had a fun table. She entertained well. She was engaging.
But things started to go wrong after Henry's death, because then Edward had had very little to do with her. She's this sort of, you know, the step aunt who really is unwanted, and why should the government fund all this money for her, you know, and that sort of thing. And they start to take away or exchange the properties she was given, and she's living on the borderline financially. And she comes under the influence of a pretty nasty man, you know, let's say he was involved in nearly every plot against Mary Tudor, put it like that.
But prior to that, she manages to maintain friendships with both Mary and Elizabeth.
Yes, despite... she does. We don't have very much evidence of her relationship with Elizabeth. We see them writing. There's a letter that probably isn't authentic, that Elizabeth is supposed to have written to her when she was six, but it's probably not. You know, it's probably a later invention. But they rode together in Mary's coronation procession right behind the Queen, in a chariot right behind the Queen. That shows how much in favour Anna was. Of course, she's a foreign princess, don't forget. We mustn't lose sight of this, and sometimes that is, you know, people don't remember this. Like Catherine of Aragon, you know, she had European form.
Yes, she was, an important dignitary.
I think she lost a lot of Mary's friendship because she was implicated in Wyatt's Rebellion through her friendship with this man, Sir Thomas Carden, who was originally her tenant at Bletchingley, one of the houses Henry gave her.
Talk to us a little bit about him. He was very intriguing.
Yes, he is. He's
a nasty little figure.
Well, I know. Dangerous little figure, you could say. Yes, he is a closet Protestant in Henry's reign. He's involved with Catherine Parr, because she was too. And he was master of the revels and tents. Yeah, and so he had providing the tents for warfare, also tents for ceremonial occasions, that kind of thing, and also revels at court, you know. And he was very well thought of. He was a secret Protestant. Under Edward, of course, he flourished. He was given grants by Henry and grants by Edward. And he managed to get... He wanted Bletchingley. He was Anna's steward or keeper there, and he wanted it. And he went to Henry behind her back, and Henry granted him the reversion on her death, which meant that as soon as she died, he got it. But he wasn't content with that. He ousted her. When Edward came to the throne, he got that tenancy. And he rowed with her attendants. She had the right to take wood from the park, and her attendants chopped down trees. Oh, he didn't like this. You know, he ran a tight ship. And there were lots of, you know, altercations, and that it wasn't an easy thing. But he got involved in Wyatt's Rebellion. He'd stored lots of arms at Bletchingley in the barn, and he had his own armoury there. And Anna was implicated, and whether she was interrogated, we don't know, but she came very near to going into the tower at that point.
Which is so fascinating.
People are not well known.
And absolutely incredible, since she had been so friendly with Mary. Mm. And it shows you how precarious at every turn. Mm. And it seems like for her, every time things are looking up, it's like kaboom.
Oh, I know it is.
Plunging it down. It's snakes and ladders all the way.
I know it is. And she's still involved with Thomas Carden, even later in Mary's reign. I mean, she moves into the house at the Royal Manor House at Dartford, and he's sending cartloads of furniture. She can't get him off her back. It's almost like he's got a Svengali sort of hold on her.
It's that, or I saw him as one of those people who's going to get, you know, that always stays just on the right side.
Yeah, that's just it, just on the right side. But indulging in nefarious activities,
playing all sides,
yes,
and
he was.
All for his own power, a user, abuser, and yet somehow they snake out of everything.
Yes, that's how I see him. And in the end, he died in his bed. Mm. But that's after he outlived Anna.
Yeah.
So, but when she died, he was in prison.
Mm.
So you know, he was up and down all the time. He was unreliable, unpredictable.
And in that relationship, she had right on her side, but he always managed to have the power.
Yeah, he did. I think he was very manipulative. And the scene where he asked her to marry him is an invention. But of course, if an ambitious man might well have, you know, but he was married, but he shows an interest in her. You get the feeling he would have just ditched his wife. We don't know what happened to his wife, whether she's still alive. We know her name earlier on.
Amazing. It's an incredible journey for her. And she, of all the queens, seems the most, in a weird way, accessible and modern to me.
Mm.
In the way that her desires were quite simple. Her desires were timeless. Her desires are the same as our desires.
Yeah.
Love and marriage and children. And
yeah, but she also liked her freedom, and the freedom to make her own choices, her own decisions, you know, and that sort of thing. And that even then there are constraints. She might have liked, she wanted to marry again. But how could she do that? Because for a long time after her annulment, there were rumours Henry wanted to take her back, and no man is going to bustle in on where the king might come.
It did strike me that she was sort of uniquely bullied. All
yep.
of the other queens had some choice.
Yeah.
I mean, Catherine of Aragon did want to marry Henry.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Anne Boleyn, you know, certainly wanted to marry
she did,
Henry.
Yeah.
And Jane Seymour wanted to marry Henry.
We assume so, yes.
Yes, she mm-hmm. seemed through what evidence
her family
we do
would have,
have.
You know,
yes, her family certainly wanted to.
Probably, yes. If she was as ambitious as the rest of her family, probably, yes.
And yet, Anne was the only one who, like, this was not...
Well, this is like Catherine of Aragon originally coming to England to marry Prince Arthur, but much younger than Anna. And Anna, it's an arranged dynastic marriage. And Anna, it's made for political reasons, and it follows the conventional pattern for that.
Yeah.
You know, long negotiations, all the quibbling about how she's going to travel and what she's going to bring with her and the dowry and the dower, you know, and all that kind of thing. That's all sorted out. And then she comes, and then you get the personal side of this. The big challenge in writing the novel was overcoming all the marriage negotiations. There's so much original source material, and thinking what to include, what not, and extrapolating the human side of it.
Yes, because every step of the journey, even to Calais. That takes eons.
Well, I mean, it's actually I quite enjoyed that because it's a part of the world I know quite well, having had so many holidays around in that part of northern Europe. So yes, I mean, I knew I could imagine it very vividly. I'd like to have done more, like when she was in Bruges. But you've got to think of the length of the book; it's very long, much longer than I expected it to be. So yes, I mean, but there is, we've got great documentation for all of this.
That is, I would assume, one of the joys,
yeah,
and
is.
Yet one of the burdens.
It is.
As
I mean,
a
the
novelist.
Reception at Blackheath, her official reception, is so detailed. You can virtually almost the novel writes itself at that point. You know, but you add in your characters and you know what their nuances and that sort of thing. But that was very easy. It's where the evidence doesn't exist that you've then got to, you know, infer.
And was she or was she not coronated?
No, she wasn't.
She was not.
No, she
coronated.
Wasn't. No, she was going to be in February, and that passed. And then she was going to be at Pentecost at Whitsun, and that didn't happen. But I mean, it's become clear. Jane Seymour, was her coronation was repeatedly deferred because first plague and then the rising known as the Pilgrimage of Grace. But I think it was dependent on her bearing a son, because Henry laid out on two coronations, previous queens, you know, and lavishly on Anne Boleyn's. And he, and I think, you know, thought the treasury was becoming empty. No, he wasn't going to do it.
The cost was too high.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is funny because as soon as Catherine Howard, he thinks Catherine Howard's pregnant, there's talk of a coronation.
Yeah. Yes. Immediately.
Yes.
Why is Anna used as a continual sort of political plot point? You know, whether she's had gossip that she might have had children, that she might be remarrying the king. I mean, these things constantly come up. Is it because of the religious component?
It is, yeah. It's the factional politics at Henry's court at this time, that there are at least two parties, reformist, some of whom are closet Protestants, because, of course, it's illegal, it's heresy. But the reformists want reform of the church from within. And Anne Boleyn was a reformist, you know, and this party is emerging very strongly with the Seymours, and, you know, towards the end of Henry's reign. And there are many of them. Of course, Cromwell was reformist too. And then there are the Catholics, the reactionaries, with the Duke of Norfolk, the Bishop of Winchester, Stephen Gardiner, and a few others. Obviously, there's others. So opinion is becoming polarised in Henry's court, and there's a lot of infighting. These factions are trying to put forward one queen, and they do put forward one queen after another. And so Henry's had so many changes of queens and changes of policy that any sort of little bit of gossip is seized upon. And, you know, because of Henry was so friendly towards Anna, people infer that he was, you know, he wanted to take her back, which is crazy when he was totally infatuated with Catherine Howard.
Yes. Yes.
And she, when Catherine Howard had her, when she, when her, at the time of her fall, Anna was poised to come to court on the instructions of the Clave ambassador.
Intrigue indeed. Mm. Next up is Catherine Howard.
Yep. Just finished.
All right, so give us a little tease.
Little tease here, yeah. I think a lot of people might be surprised to know that Catherine had an affair when she was married with Thomas Culpepper. That they actually fell in love before she married the king. So that's, a lot of people aren't aware of that. They think that arose during that. But what does come across strongly, and which I can't really put very much in the book, there is a hint in the book, was I don't think Henry VIII intended to have Catherine beheaded. I think it was the reformists on the council who were actually around at the time. The council had been split, and these were the ones who had been sort of left to their own devices. And I think that they are the ones who drove it, who blocked any avenue of appeal or evidence that could have saved her, and who made sure the king was distanced from it.
That the habit of beheading, not only did it decimate his bedroom, but it also decimated his council. So that was constantly having to be refreshed.
I mean, actually, if you think about it now, I mean, there weren't that many councillors who were beheaded. You know, I mean, Thomas Cromwell was the spectacular one. Wolsey might have ended up on the block. And there were one or two, but really, basically, it's, you look at, people think, oh, Henry VIII had all these people put to death. It's a tiny proportion of the people who were at court and serving him. And most of them were pretty pragmatic people who bent with the wind and, you know, went and did exactly what he wanted them to do. But you can see them relieving the king of the burden of this terrible investigation, because it's impacted on him so badly emotionally. And there's no doubt that that's genuine. That is not feigned. And he was pretty depressed for some time afterwards. And he was ailing. He was prematurely aged. It was his last fling. You know, he hasn't got much to look forward to now. It came at an awful time for him, and he actually cried in council. And so the councillors, they even get to the stage where they literally use a seal manual and a signature, and they stamp the bill of attainder, which becomes an act of attainder, condemning Catherine to death. She wasn't tried.
Wow.
But there's, the only thing I could put in the book about this was because it's all from her point of view. She wouldn't have known that someone has heard that the king is wants to sentence, it might be in perpetual imprisonment. And that's what one report says Henry intended.
Well, we all this to come.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing your research. And
thank you
for infusing these novels with such a unique perspective.
Thank you so much. And lovely to speak to you again.
Fantastic. For more fascinating women, go to www.radiogorgeous.com.
Wow. Thank you so much.